for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. My name is Anna.
And I'm Sam.
And we have reached a very fun moment in Star Wars history. This week, our chronological watch through has run us up to Andor, which came out in 2022.
This is a very recent live action show. It came out, people were surprised that there was a show coming out about this character, Cassian Andor, because he's in Rogue One and that's the end of his story. But we are really ramping up in this Rise of the Empire, Age of the Empire era, what's going on. And it's a thriller.
Oh my God. I get butterflies every time we start a new series. And I especially got butterflies for this one because there's just, oh, it's so good. There's so much to talk about. Mm-hmm. So we're covering season one, episode one, season premiere, Casa.
Casa.
Which I read it, and my brain autocorrected it to Casa?
No, that's what you dip chips in.
Okay, Sam. All right.
Sorry, I haven't had breakfast yet. All right. How do we start this one off?
Okay. The year, BBY5. The location, Morlana 1, at night, in the rain. The vibes, spooky.
It's cyberpunk to the max. There's like bubbles in the walls of these alleyways and it's raining like torrentially and there's people like dancing in these bubbles like on the streets, but there's no one on the streets. It's very, very cyberpunk.
Yeah. It's a Star Wars red light district.
Yes.
Which is dark for Star Wars. So our main character, Cassian, didn't actually know that his last name was Andor. So thank you for putting that piece of the puzzle in for me. So now I know why the show is named Andor.
Yeah,
okay. That's helpful.
Yeah. They're really bad about names in this show. I just need to be clear. I'm going to refer to people by their names, and we don't know them in universe yet.
Yeah, I'm going to confirm a bunch of names with you because I was hashtag confused. Welcome to life as a new viewer in Star Wars 2022. Just no context.
So
just
Cassian Andor walking through the red light district, getting 4 to 6 gallons of rain dumped on him per second.
Hustling through the rain into this seedy downtown, he makes his way to a very bougie intergalactic brothel. Mm-hmm. Also words that I never thought were going to come out of my mouth in a Star Wars show. Cassian, our main character, is immediately propositioned by the madam of this establishment who asks him what sort of entertainment he's looking for tonight. And he tells her that he's interested in a girl from Canary he heard was working there. So she goes into the back. She comes back. There was a gal from Canary. She was working here. She disappeared months ago. No trace, no deets, no name. And it turns out Cassian is looking for his sister.
Mm-hmm. But this whole time, the presumably off-duty cops at the brothel are hassling him and everyone.
Yeah, there's some kind of off-duty Imperial sentry guards. They pick a fight with him. Cassian leaves. They go chasing after him in the rain. They're threatening him with fines and citations and whatever other nasty, petty stuff they can pull out of their back pockets. And Cassian goes off in this dark alleyway. He puts his hands up and he's like, I got 300 credits in my pocket. Come and get it. And then the younger guard comes and fishes around in his pocket and Cassian whacks his head back and the guy goes down. And then he gets into this just nasty brawl with the older guard. He gets the upper hand. He holds him at blaster point. And when everyone comes up for air, Cassian killed the one dude.
Maybe the younger dude either died when the older guard fired some gunshots as they were scuffling for the gun, or Cassian headbutted him and hit like the bridge of his nose and shattered his brain. Or Cassian headbutted him into a wall and he broke his neck.
Deeply unclear. What is clear is that Cassian has to make a decision. So he deliberates in the rain. He eventually kills the second guard with his own blaster.
No witnesses.
Leaves them there in the rain, races back down the causeway to his ship, and yeets off into space. And then we spend the rest of the episode basically following Cassian through a day in the life as a Star Wars rogue.
Mm-hmm.
He lives on the planet Ferrix in a junkyard, and he has this janky droid named B2, which I didn't know, but the subtitles told me. So, Sam, you are absolutely correct about names in this show.
B2 introduces himself. B2 is a talking droid, but he's kind of got an astromech form factor. He's like 3 feet tall, and he kind of looks like a fire hydrant, which is joked upon because a bunch of space dogs come by and pee on him until he zorches them. And he's cute, but he like stutters, and he's got like a... Oh, I'm sorry. And it costs a lot of energy for me to lie. So Cassian is trying to get B2 to make an alibi for him.
Yeah, Cassian immediately begins roping everyone into his schemes and plans. So he gets B2 to concoct an alibi for him. He hunts down his friend Brasso, who works in the mines, I guess, and gets Brasso to agree to this big old story to explain the shiner on his face.
Mm-hmm.
Then he runs over to the mechanic shop, where he's got a friend named Bix, and he gets her to call in a contact so he can sell a really expensive ship he's been sitting on and get off planet.
It's not a ship. It's an NS9 Starpath unit, and it's basically a handheld device, and he's still got, like, the factory stickers on it and everything. It's still got the anti-tamper stuff on it.
Mint condition.
Yes, but it is an incredibly valuable piece of Imperial military equipment.
So he gets Bix to call that in to some mysterious contact.
Secret friend.
He dodges his quote-unquote frenemy, Nurchi, like a pro, even though he owes this guy Nurchi a lot of money. And Nurchi brought their 9-foot alien friend Vetch to threaten Cassian.
So we've learned that Cassian is running around. Everyone is sick of his BS.
Yeah, he's been calling in a lot of favors and burning through them real fast. And he has not apparently been offering any favors in return.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone is sick of Cassian. Finally, he takes a trip to the junkyard or the salvage yard to fix up the ship that he borrowed the night before.
He's swapping out VIN plates, basically.
That is so sketchy.
He is so sketchy.
He is a sketchy MF-er.
Yeah.
I wish I could swear on this podcast. Okay, so Cassian has been running around doing his dodgy errands. However, actual trouble is actually brewing for him back on Morlana One. So he is correct to be this paranoid.
In the B-plot.
In the B-plot, there is this very eager Tobey Maguire as Spider-Man looking deputy inspector who is very serious about his job, and he is ready to run Cassian down to the ends of the galaxy for killing these dumb guards. But his boss is so not all about it. There's this amazing scene where the deputy inspector is all ready to start an investigation on Cassian, and his boss just railroads him and calls every shot the way it happened last night. And he's like, cover it up. I don't want to tell the Imperial high-ups that our crime rates now include these two dead guards.
Mm-hmm.
Deuces.
This deputy inspector's name is Cyril Karn, if that helps.
Thank you for filling that in. No thank you to the scriptwriters for not filling that in. So Karn's boss leaves for some Imperial middle management conference of, I guess, security bros. And then with free rein, the deputy inspector goes off and starts digging. He assigns all of his new Imperial lackeys to put out a call for Canary men on Ferrix, because that's where they figure out Cassian went home to.
Importantly, they're not actually Imperial. Cyril's not Imperial. His boss isn't Imperial. They're corporate security.
Oh.
So they're mall cops. And Cyril is just the try-hardiest mall cop to ever try hard.
He has so thoroughly tailored his uniform that it's like glued to his nipples.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a lot.
And he's walking around with the posture of someone who's had their spine replaced with a stick up their butt.
He's got like a diving board instead of vertebrae. He's just a character. Okay, last thing we need to talk about. The whole episode has been interspersed with flashbacks of presumably Cassian's childhood on the planet Canary. He lived with this tribe of youths on a forest planet with his sister, who now, as an adult, he's looking for. And in one of these flashbacks, all of the kids watch one day from their beautiful forest village as this massive star cruiser crashes on their planet in the distance, and they all suit up in war paint to go see what the deal is.
Mm-hmm.
And the episode ends with Cassian, or Kasa, leaving his sister behind to go investigate this star cruiser.
Yep.
And I know that sounded anticlimactic, and it was also anticlimactic in the show. So that's how the first episode ends.
But we have set in motion so many wheels for what this show is going to be.
Yeah. What do you want to talk about?
I want to start with just Cassian Andor as a character, as someone who's running around, and he has this really important moment at the beginning. So he's walking into this cyberpunk bar and is like, hey, I'm just looking for information. I'm following up on a rumor. And the mall cops get so up in his business. And he's like, I do not want to deal with mall cops. Like, I am doing illegal stuff. I do not want to be involved with mall cops right now.
So I guess the reason that I thought they were Imperial and not just mall security was the hard edge that Cassian has when he's talking to them, right? Like, first of all, I mean, I get it. The madam ignores them because mm-hmm. she's also fed up with them,
mm-hmm.
feeling like they're really cool when they're really just Paul Blart from Mall Cop.
Mm-hmm.
But when Cassian is trying to not talk to them, he is very subversive in a way. Like, he is disrespecting their authority, which you can read in a lot of different ways. I read it as Cassian is up to bigger stuff than what these guys are all about. But the mall cops read it as he's flaunting how little authority they have.
Yeah.
So I read it as, I guess, like a proto-rebel versus Imperial Stormtrooper vibe, because that's what I've been primed, because we've been watching Rebels.
Maybe. It's pretty scary, though, because in the next scene, in the murders in the alleyway, they pull a gun on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like walking away, and they're just insulting him, and they're calling him all these things. Almost up to the point of calling him like a wetback, which would have been a horrific slur for a Hispanic actor to be called by white actors, which is like definitely the move they're making. They're like, oh, are you a swimmer? Did you swim across? And it's like, oh my gosh, what do you, that's such a crazy thing to neatly wrap around, that these cops are just like so hyped up on their own authority. And then we later learn that they were way shady already. And so it's like, and when Andor wins the fight, which he obviously does, and he's sitting there and he's got his gun, he's pointing it at the one, the older one, who's still kneeling there because they don't yet realize that the younger one is dead. And he says, what do you want me to do?
Yeah.
Which is such the way one would interact with cops when they're just going to have their way with you and you are not up for it. Like, so many videos exist of cops rolling up and yelling at someone, particularly a minority.
Provoking them.
Yeah, to be like, hands up, on the ground, hands in pockets, stand up, on your knees. And then when you don't comply to all of those conflicting orders,
they kill you.
They kill you.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because my prevailing sense, even from the first 15 minutes of Kasa, but all the way through the episode, is how much real world American baggage Andor has brought into Star Wars. And the throwdown with the police was just one element. I think it's very telling that from the first minute of Andor, we're dealing with the trafficking of sentient beings. So we walk through this alleyway where there's glass bubbles, right? Mm-hmm. And it becomes immediately evident that some of these sentient beings are on offer for sex,
mm-hmm.
which is really edgy for Star Wars. But there's also a couple of aliens who are snarling and kind of, you know, throwing their fists at the glass. And it feels like you could hire them to fight.
Yeah.
So there's this gritty, dark, seedy undertone where anybody can be bought for your pleasure,
mm-hmm.
whether it's physical pleasure or to kill or to fight against. And that is just really new territory for Star Wars, especially because we just came off of Rebels, which is actually the answer to Clone Wars. It is a kid's show.
Yeah.
So this is like a slap in the face as far as tone shift. But I think that also makes it feel more real, right?
Well, not just the fact that it's live action, but the fact that coming out in 2022 in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement and the backlash against chronic integral police brutality in America, something like this as a starter of how police brutality can be a catalyst for someone. Some of these people are going to be fed up enough to do something drastic. And that is what happened when these two cops went after Cassian. He's like, yeah, he didn't mean to kill them.
But no.
He was willing to. And once the situation went there, he's like, now I just need to find an alibi. But then he spends the rest of the episode trying to move this Starpath unit. It seems like it's worth a lot of money, enough to pay off all of his debts and to get him out of town for a while. So he's really trying to escalate the situation such that he can stay alive.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that I really appreciated, even from the first 15 minutes of Andor, is that the pacing feels very authentic as well. So the length of time that Cassian spends deliberating about whether or not he should kill the second cop is the amount of time that I think a human being would need in that situation, mm-hmm. right? So no, he doesn't want to kill the cop. He's not prepared to. As he's standing in the dark, in the rain, he has to mentally prepare himself to commit a murder. And that is the correct amount of time to make those decisions if you're under pressure, mm-hmm. right? I get so used to the animated shows that we've been watching in Star Wars and action thrillers, media where people just make instant snap decisions where they never need time to process. But this is actually the speed at which people think.
This basically has the action of a slow episode of Law and Order where there is like a crime in the beginning and then a bunch of people talking.
Yeah.
And that makes it very, very fun.
Yeah. And just, I think nobody in real life is as heroic or awesome as the movies. And I like that Andor is already carving this path out for Cassian, where he is a slippery, kind of self-centered, non-heroic rogue with a semi-noble but kind of shady, obsessive cause, which is to find his sister. But he's not a moral compass. He's not a hero. He doesn't spare the life of the mall cop just to make his life easier. He kills that guy.
Well, I think he knew. So the mall cop is sitting there begging for his life. And he's like, it was an accident. You bumped into him. We didn't realize. You're kind of slow. And I think Cassian is like, this dude's going to throw me under the bus if I let him live.
Absolutely. And then we do get that follow-up dialogue with Karn and his boss, where mm-hmm. the boss is like, oh, I know that guy. He was a deeply unpleasant dude.
I'm surprised no one's killed him yet. I wrote down that dialogue because it's really important. So the boss says, I need you to conjure an accident. And Cyril says, but they were murdered. And the boss says, no. They were killed in a fight. They were in a brothel, which we're not supposed to have, the expensive one, which they're not supposed to be able to afford, drinking Revnog, which we're not allowed to allow. Both of them on the job, which is a dismissible offense. They clearly harassed a human with dark features and chose the wrong person to annoy. And that is exactly what happened.
It's literally what happened. I loved that scene.
And the boss is like, yeah, I don't want to start problems here.
Well, he's walking out of his office to go to some Imperial conference for middle managers.
Where he has to be like reporting, oh, this Preox Morgana is like cool. Like we are right in the middle. He says that to Cyril. He says the point of this, if you ever are called upon to do it, is brevity.
Yeah. Since you brought up that we're on Preox Morlana, whatever that is, can we talk about the setting of where Cassian is looking for information? So I've never heard of Preox Morlana, which is not atypical as a new viewer. I've literally only seen what has happened in Star Wars up to this point. I'm on a lot of new planets all the time. But I would have thought that I would have at least heard of what was going on here. Cassian walks into this corporate zone, which appears to be a section of businesses that purely serve whatever force is here, and it's not Imperial. What is going on here?
So, Morlana 1 is a company town for some multi-planet segment of the galaxy being run by a corporation. Mm. And that corporation sort of has like a charter from the Empire to extract as much as they can. So they run company towns. And they ostensibly also run Ferrix. And so that's why Cyril is able to later track down a ship that has like unmarked, no VIN plates, but he is later on tracking down the ship that Cassian used to Ferrix. But he's like, yeah, we ostensibly control this planet, but we really don't, because Ferrix itself is like a junkyard planet. And Morlana 1, we really don't know much about. It seems urban and cyberpunk.
Okay. But Morlana 1, the corporation, the corporation that runs Morlana 1.
It's called Preox hyphen Morlana, yeah.
So Preox hyphen Morlana oversees what, mining operations?
I mean, it's probably a big vertically and horizontally integrated fascist subcompany that does like everything. They do mining, they do ships, they do, you know, drugs, they do everything. There's really nothing stopping a company from expanding into as many territories as they want to when their mandate is to like, hey, the Empire says you guys have bribed enough officials to please take over this area. So now they're the company town. And that means that they're providing food at terrible rates. They're like, you can't afford to get out of it. And so they provide the food, they provide the lodging, they provide the transportation.
Brothels.
So, yeah. And so there's no way out of it. And that's why the boss is like, there is a nice brothel. He knew it was a nice brothel. In fact, when Cyril's like, then they walked into the alleyway and he's describing the alleyway and the boss is like, I know the location. I know exactly where they died already. Mm. The boss knows about the nice brothel. The boss knows how much the nice brothel costs. Aww. He knows that it's more than these guys get paid. So he knows that there is a lot going on to ease the wheels of this whole situation. And that's like what he's all about.
That is another reason why I brought up the baggage that Andor is bringing from our world into mm-hmm. Star Wars. I wanted to talk about class.
Okay.
In this episode, we see a lot of it, specifically in the scene that you just described. But I think throughout, and I'm thinking about this especially because we so recently watched Obi-Wan Kenobi, where we got a more nuanced picture of what life is like for the have-nots in mm-hmm. the galaxy. So I'm thinking about how many blue-collar workers we saw between Kenobi and Andor. In Kenobi, we see all of the whale meat farmers on Tatooine. And then here in Andor, we're seeing these schmucks who work for Preox Morlana. We're seeing people like Brasso, who work presumably in the mines.
It seems like, honestly, a brick factory, just because the whole city on Ferrix, it's gorgeous. It's got these beautiful arcs, but everything is also made out of red bricks.
And there's like just, it's just a red and yellow kind of mud-daubed city.
It's really cool, and it's also a real set that was made in England.
Oh my god, that's so cool. Is that why there's so many Scottish accents in Andor?
I think so. That's also just a Star Wars thing. Mm. I love this, that in live action, they actually have to get like actors, and very rarely are the actors for Star Wars big name actors from somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
They're either big name actors from Star Wars, or it's like specifically, we want someone who very few people will recognize. And that's true of basically all the actors in this.
That's very fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we also see Bix, who is a mechanic on Ferrix.
Yeah, we also see Bix, who's a mechanic on Ferrix.
And her boyfriend, who's literally named Tim.
Yeah. Space Tim.
Space Tim with two M's.
They work together. He runs the front of the shop and she runs the back of the shop. And so we're introduced to her and she's like elbows deep in a jet engine, which is cool.
Extremely cool. I love female mechanics. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about all of these blue collar workers. I'm thinking about Han Solo, who grew up on Corellia in a children's thieving guild. And all of a sudden, it makes these actually imperial jobs, not the Preox Morlana corporate jobs so much, but it makes imperial jobs seem like this golden ticket out of poverty or poverty-adjacent lifestyles. When we see Tala in Obi-Wan Kenobi, she's a high-ranking imperial commander who I would guess has a pretty cushy life compared to the rest of these people who are eking out a living in the galaxy.
Tala probably funded a significant portion of the hidden path by herself with whatever she was making. And it very much shows that, like, all these dudes on Ferrix who are running around hassling Cassian for money, and Cassian's like hassling them up for money, and he's sitting there and he's got 300 credits, which doesn't, as far as we know, because it's a space economy, it's nonsensical. It doesn't genuinely seem like a lot.
We know from Solo that it would not have been enough to bribe your way off of Corellia. They needed 800 credits for that.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, if it's maybe like $300, if he's like, I have $300 in my pocket, will that resolve the situation? But that's like not a ton of money. And that's how much he's been able to scrape together from scamming everyone, literally everyone on his home planet.
Literally everyone. He's got so few friends left. He knows a lot of people and they are all fed up with him.
Yeah.
And Brasso specifically says, I'm not going to lend you any more money.
Yeah.
So I am getting a fuller picture of what the actual tyrannical fascist state of life is under the Empire. And it's bad.
Yeah.
It's the kind of abject everyday struggle that is familiar to a lot of people on our planet. Mm-hmm. But we were introduced chronologically to the Phantom Menace and to Attack of the Clones. We hung out with Jedi. We hung out with senators. All of a sudden, when you compare what life is like on Ferrix to what life was like for Padme Amidala, I mean, it makes Padme with her beautiful, you know, towering senatorial apartment and her panoramic glass view wall and her hair and her costumes and the Jedi with their incredible temple just soaring over Coruscant. Mm-hmm. It makes them all of a sudden, in retrospect, seem so out of touch.
And we talk about that at length in several arcs, the Jedi Temple bombing arc, the Martez sisters arc. Mm-hmm. And then later on when we see Kenobi working at the fish factory on Tatooine, and now in Andor, we see all the work that has to go in order to keep the Empire clean and bright and happy. And I think, yeah, there's very much an exploitative system at play, and it is so exploitative and so brutally imposed that there's no escape. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the point.
Yeah. So we know Cassian. We know Cassian is not trying to escape, but it seems like he's trying to eke out some sort of retributive justice.
Maybe. Right now, at the end of this episode, he's got this NS9 Starpath unit he's trying to sell. He knows from his ex-girlfriend, Bix Kaleen, that there is, she has a friend who, she does like mildly sketchy salvage. And so they have a fight over like where he got this. Was it one of her bids? Like, did he steal it from her? And he's like, not this time. And also, we both steal from each other. This is why we're not dating.
Do you think they used to date?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And they were also in some kind of sketchy business parts dealing together?
Yeah. I mean, and she's still in that, but that's why Tim, the Space Tim, is like...
Space Tim.
That's why Space Tim is super sus of Cassian all the time. And when Bix is running around and she's like, hey, I need to make a phone call, like, I need to go run errands. Her boyfriend follows her throughout the city.
Not very well.
No.
He rolled a 2 on his stealth.
She was not doing a good job not being followed, though. She didn't even look back once or do anything.
I don't think she thought her boyfriend Space Tim was capable of following her, which he was not. So she was correct.
So there you go. But she ends up making a very intriguing call. She crawls up like a radio tower, and on the inside, she's clicking wires together with her hands to make a phone call somewhere. But Cassian has got some large, high-value item. He's looking to sell it. He knows from his ex-girlfriend a buyer who will buy these type of high-value items. It's very illegal to own and sell, and that will pay off all of his debts. However, because he committed murders, he now needs to get off planet for a while and hide. That's like what he's up to, and that, I think, says everything we need to know about Cassian in this moment.
Okay.
Is like the situation he is in, because you look at someone like Brasso, who is big and friendly and works in the mine and seems to have a good time.
Yeah, he dropped by to bring dinner over because I guess he knows that Cassian can't afford to eat dinner.
Well, it's because Cassian lives with his mom, Marva.
That was not evident to me.
It's talked about a lot. We'll meet her later. And she's very friendly and friends with everyone. So
Cassian lives with his mom.
Yeah.
And he still can't squeeze more than 300 credits together. He's not paying rent.
He's real sketchy.
God, Cassian.
He's real sketchy. Yeah. So whatever he's up to is on some sort of different plan of sketchiness. And it shows a similar type of thing of like Lando in the Puffer Pig episode in Rebels.
Oh, my God.
And Han Solo in Solo.
Uh-huh.
And honestly, the lineage of Hondo Ohnaka of just like, I'm just trying to get by. The rules are BS. I don't want to deal with the rules. I just want to lie, cheat, and steal to have enough money. And it turns out that it's literally exactly as much work and exactly as profitable as having a day job.
Yeah. So, just with worse hours.
Yeah. It's a real bummer how hard scam artists have to work in the Star Wars universe.
Oh,
honestly.
My God. I mean, also the Bad Batch. We now have 2 seasons of Bad Batch
and
under
Sid,
our belt.
And yeah, there's a lot of scams in the Bad Batch.
There's a lot of people working really hard, doing so much for so little in Star Wars. And some of them are doing it honestly. And some of them are just trying to raise their space teenagers and put food on the table. And they're all working so hard for so little. Except I don't have a lot of sympathy for Cassian.
Why not? Compared to the Bad Batch, compared to Hondo, compared to Solo, compared to Calrissian.
Listen, Hondo loves kids. He loved those Jedi younglings. Even though he was not nice to them, he loved them. Who wouldn't love them?
Okay, because Hondo is a weakway, I don't know what his biochemistry is, but I'm pretty sure he's addicted to something because his...
Cocaine uncle?
Yeah, his up and down is so ridiculous within the same episode, so I know it's on purpose. And in the episodes where you see him very emotionally up and down, I'm like, oh, someone is referring to their like alcoholic aunt who is like, here's $100 and a pony, and also your mother never loved you. Like, holy crap.
Sam, we've had this conversation.
Yeah,
in the Jedi Younglings arc, we talked about how Hondo's the drunk uncle.
Yeah, he is. And I just don't want to sing his praises. He's a sketchy dude. And Solo is sketchy, and Calrissian is sketchy. And, I mean, Kira is sketchy.
Kira reminded me a lot, or maybe the madam of the brothel reminded me a lot of Kira, of these hyper-competent women in shady situations who have to deal with sketchy men all the time.
And who very neatly avoid getting their hands dirty in all these things.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's a really, yeah. I mean, that's something that I think is really important for being a criminal, for being in those criminal elements, is to have other people do your dirty work.
Notes for our aspiring criminals among the listenership.
You know, one of our listeners, John from the FSF Popcast, called me out on that because we do the Popcast monthly Star Wars D&D campaign. And he's like, Sam, I've been listening to Growing Up Skywalker to learn tips for running a terrorist cell. I'm like, oh, man.
Oh, no. Actually, on that note, Let's move away from just domestic crime. Let's talk about international crime.
Go big or go home.
Go big or go home, friends. Okay, international intergalactic crime discussion starting now. I wanted to talk about Canary.
All right, so this episode takes place on three separate planets, Preox Morlana 1 and Ferrix and Canary.
So I was thinking about Canary in terms of other exploited natural resource planets we've seen before. And specifically, I was thinking about the Kashyyyk arc in Bad Batch Season 2.
Interesting.
So in Bad Batch Season 2, we are hanging out on Kashyyyk with our fave baby Jedi Gungi.
Who's like teen Gungi.
Teen Gungi. Oh, I love him so much. Okay, I'm not going to get distracted because this is horrifying. We see Kashyyyk is being overrun by the Empire because it's being logged, it's being mined, and the native Wookiees are being enslaved and carted off planet to be laborers for the Empire. And the vibe that I got between Canary and Kashyyyk was something in international relations and political science studies called the natural resource curse.
Yes.
Which is where colonizers will, mostly nations, but sometimes corporations that belong to a nation.
The line between the two is very blurry and small.
Which I think we see a lot in Andor already. But these corporations and nations will go into natural resource-rich places and extract goods from those places that in and of themselves are not worth a lot, but then they will attach symbolic value. So maybe it's gasoline, maybe it's minerals, maybe it's gemstones. And then they will sell the materials that they took from that quote-unquote lesser nation and sell them for a massive profit. But the nation from which they originated never benefits from those profits, even though they were most likely providing the labor and being impoverished in the taking, right? So that was a lot. TLDR, big corporation comes in, takes worthwhile stuff from a poor place, impoverishes it in the taking, and gets rich off of the back of that place. So that's what we're seeing on Kashyyyk. That was the beginning of the vibe that I was getting from Canary.
Interesting. We're going to explore that a bit further. I think it's really important to explore that in all of Star Wars because the internal and external colonization of other planets, that's like what that turns into, is the exploitation of labor because you go to these places, you have the people work, you pay them a pittance or nothing to work their own land to give you something that you can sell to enrich yourself elsewhere.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's colonization. And it's the danger of that. There's many dangers of that. One of the really spicy dangers of that is if you do it internally, like if you take a part of your own country or your own planet and you exploit it, then you're selling things out to the wider world and you're probably not getting the best deal you possibly could. So you're exploiting yourselves. And that is what the stage of capitalism we're in, sort of the post-colonial stage, is all about, is getting people to exploit themselves for hustle lifestyle or whatever.
Which, in a way, we're seeing, I think, people on Ferrix who are kind of buying into that system for the Empire. And all of our scam artists are trying to subvert that. They're trying to not exploit themselves. They're trying to exploit back.
So, circling back to Canary, I don't think we know enough yet about what's going on Canary because the pictures we have, there's a village. We don't see anyone over the age of like 16.
Yeah.
And a ship deorbits, explodes, and crashes. And they're like, hey, that's within walking distance. Let's go check it out.
Right. What I picked up on, because no, we don't know how the Canary story is going to go. We do have one context clue from the first 2 minutes of Casa, which is when Cassian says Canary was a small planet in the mid-rim. So I think we're setting up this Qunari storyline to possibly be maybe even grimmer than the Wookiee Kashyyyk story, which is horrifying already. But the Qunari storyline feels like it's going to be not just a colonization story, but possibly a genocide story or a Tapoka City from Bad Batch slagging an entire planet kind of story.
Or it might be, as we've seen with the Imperial era, the banality of evil might be more callous even than that. And it might be, I mean, the fact that this whole village is made up of children, it might be that like all their parents were taken away and the kids were just left behind to fend for themselves. Because it's a real Lord of the Flies situation there. They're wandering around and like the oldest girl is the one who lets Cassian into the party because he's getting slapped. Because he's like a rangy 10-year-old, rangy 12-year-old maybe.
I thought maybe 12 or 13.
Yeah, and it seems like he's almost too young, but not quite to go on this expedition.
I got the vibe that he was old enough, but he just already wasn't well-liked, which kind of tracks with how he seems as an adult.
A little bit, yeah.
So we get a lot of village stories in Star Wars, and some of them are more idyllic than others. I'm thinking about, on the idyllic end, you have Ahsoka Tano's origin story in Tales of the Jedi in the beautiful Togruden village, which seems lovely. Kind of in the mid-zone, you get village stories like in Season 1 of The Clone Wars with the Lurmen, who are a pacifist people who are then exploited by the Empire and almost overtaken.
My gosh, that episode, most influential episode of The Clone Wars is the Lurmen arc. Go back and watch, well, when go back and check that one out.
When have we ever not referenced this arc the podcast?
That's crazy.
And then on the other end, you get things like the Wookiee story.
Where it's like full-on exploitation. Or the one in Bad Batch Season 2 when there's like child laborers working in the pit mine?
Absolutely, in Mako Town.
Mako Town, right.
So there's a spectrum of village stories, and it feels like we're setting up this Qunari story to be a simple people are suddenly exposed to Imperial control, and then they are no longer a people. Yikes.
Yeah. The other flip of that may be they're a simple people who are the survivors of a crash and no one came for them.
Ooh, that has a Clone Wars backstory too, which is the other Wookiee storyline, which is when Ahsoka gets thrown onto the slave moon to be hunted down by
the Trandoshans.
The Trandoshans, yeah.
Yeah. So in a universe, in a galaxy where very few people care, it's really hard to get credit, bribes abound. Welcome to Star Wars.
Welcome to Star Wars.
Yeah. It's remarkable to me how all of the people who are telling Cassian no are people who are self-policing.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's all people who are like, I can't do that for you. I'm exposing myself too much to what? Like, we don't see any guards. We don't see any military presence on Ferrix, and everyone's already telling Cassian no. And then when we're talking about Cyril, Cyril tracks the ship to Ferrix, and he's like, we control Ferrix, don't we? And one of his little minions, who he kept up all night because he is literally the worst boss ever, is like, we don't like the Ferrix people do their own thing. They send us stuff and we take it. And that's like, end of transaction. We don't get involved in their business. But Cyril's not taking that for an answer. So yeah, the idea of people self-policing just to try to stay out of trouble makes a troublemaker even more of a outcast.
There are layers in Andor already. And I think the self-policing is just one layer of just how people and sentient beings are controlled. This is very like Foucault, right? But yeah, there's different layers of control. And the deepest layer is how you control yourself to feel like you're keeping yourself safe. So in a way, anybody who's subverting the system is pretty courageous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe I've been too hard on Cassian.
No, he's still sketchy.
Okay.
He's still real sketchy. He's especially sketchy.
But you know, I appreciate, this is the final thing that I wanted to talk about. I appreciate the way that Andor as a show has been set up so far, where it created this feeling of claustrophobia for me. We're never getting panoramic views of planets to see where we are.
Oh, yeah.
And we're never getting a full context or full picture of what people are up to.
Mm-hmm.
We're thrust in kind of close-up portrait view of a bunch of different things all happening. And it gave me this feeling as a viewer of being out of my depth and kind of paranoid and hunted and watched and slow on the uptake. And I loved it because this is probably how everyone is feeling in the show.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
That, my friends, is art with a capital A.
An
E at the end.
This show is so well done, and it's amazing watching it because it is Star Wars with no stunts and like no special effects. It is just like sets and people and talking, and it tells a really tight, compelling story from an emotional level. This is great.
This is great television.
I'm reminded of how when I read the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov, which are fantastic, how the whole thing could have been played out on a Shakespearean stage because all of the like mega space battles and everything take place off scene, and everything is like people meeting in a room having tough conversations.
Ooh.
And how that is in fact what Andor is as well. It's people having tough conversations. This could have played out on a Shakespearean stage, and that is like the core of theater, of television, of art. Is this is a very real story. It requires very little suspension of disbelief to imagine your sketchy friend went out and he's like, hey, I need an alibi. I was across state lines the other night and I killed a cop, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what was the critical reception of if not Andor as a whole, then maybe this first episode.
So, you know, the critical reception is such a meaningless term now because of the way that like Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic and everything work, that like basically everyone who watches this really likes it. Not many people watch it.
Okay.
So it's one of those. And I see why. The first couple episodes of the other live action series, I mean, Kenobi has a slow start, but there's lightsabers pretty rapidly.
Well, Kenobi has maybe more of an instigating plot in the first episode than mm-hmm. Andor did, because right now we've just got a murder or two murders simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And Kenobi episode one at least had Kenobi beginning to jet off across the galaxy in search of Leia.
Mm-hmm.
But this plot, this episode ended pretty abruptly.
Yeah, it did.
So it's a little bit less self-contained than Kenobi was.
Mm-hmm. So as we said, it's very artistic. It's very much a form of art. It is not something that is bite-sized for conspicuous consumption. It's not a show which you would sit down and just even binge watch. I tried, when I watched it, I was like binge watching. I was watching like two episodes a night and I really couldn't stop myself because I enjoyed it. But if I sat down to watch all of them in a whole day, I would miss so much of the details.
Yeah.
So this is designed to be something that is a slow burn, that is a thinker, and that intentionality of design shows up.
I mean, I love television designed to be savored. Even the way that I watched this first episode, we had a party to go to last night. So I watched the first maybe 18 minutes, mm-hmm. right? I got to Cassian going over to Barrasso to start concocting his alibi. And then I had to jump in the shower and leave, and we had to go to this party. And as I was in the shower, I thought of 18 things that mm-hmm. were different that I wanted to talk about. Right? And that doesn't always happen in television. So I love television designed to be savored. I love media that gives me time to breathe in the universe. We talk about this a lot with the live action Star Wars shows and the quote unquote slower shows.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have heard maybe good things about Andor. I've also heard that it's really, really slow. And I just feel firm enough in my preferences to say slow is a good thing.
And not every story, particularly a story in this era of the Star Wars arc, and with Cassian Andor as the hero, as the protagonist at least, it makes sense that he's not sitting there riding a Star Destroyer like Slim Pickens into the atmosphere of a planet somewhere, at least not yet.
He had to borrow his friend's ship to go over state lines.
And then like swap out the VIN. Yeah. he's sketchy and he's doing that type of thing because that's the story we want to tell. That's the scale we want to be at, and it's a good place to be.
It is a good place to be. Another good place to be is talking about Baywatch.
Yeah.
Is it time for Baywatch?
Sure is.
Let's... Oh, God, I forgot how the song goes.
It's time for Baywatch. Beep, beep.
Sam. Mm. Who is your bae?
There's no one in this episode. We don't even learn anyone's names. We learn like Brass's name and Bix's name and Cassian's name. We don't learn Tim's name, Space Tim.
Apparently, Cassian lives with his mom, and I didn't even pick up on that.
Named Marva. We learn B2's name. We don't learn Cyril's name. We don't learn Cyril's boss's name.
We actually don't learn B2's name. We just get one letter, which is B.
That's all he needs. Well, I mean, it's got to be Cassian. And it's a tough one. It's honestly a tough one, but it's his story. And I really, so I've been arrested a couple of times and I don't like recommend that experience for everyone. I don't recommend getting tear gassed to everyone, but it's an important thing to be aware of for yourself. And the sense of frustration that Cassian feels in that opening scene when he has the guard's gun and he says, what do you want me to do? Mm-hmm. That speaks to me at a deep primal level as someone who has been a troublemaker, less now, slightly.
Sam is a lot more straight and narrow these days.
You know, I always was. And that's what makes it so dark to like fall off that path is that like people have such high expectations of you. Cassian has such low expectations that he's able to get away with so much. But the idea of, what do you want me to do? How is this situation supposed to play out now that it is more consensual? Ooh. Now that you're not pointing a gun at me? I mean, in Solo, Tobias Beckett says that when he shoots the guards. And like, what are you doing? He says, I'm thinking, and I prefer to be the only one with guns when I'm thinking. And I'm like, whoa. Like, that is actually a meaningful thing. And that's what Cassian is doing too. He's like, I'm thinking, and I prefer to be the only one with guns when I'm thinking. Because
he's evening the odds.
He's evening the odds, and that's the only way forward. And he has no remorse about this. He just has to deal with the consequences. And I know that that's not something that is lauded as a good quality in someone, but I think it's a valuable quality for society to have, is people who are willing to do something and deal with the consequences for it, and the thing itself matters less, because sometimes big changes need to happen. And we've talked before about how it takes, you know, 3% of the population of a country in nonviolent rebellion to cause an overthrow. It takes simultaneously fewer and more in a violent state, but also the system brings violence, and sometimes the only way to fight violence is with violence.
Well, and also systems that want to remain in power benefit a lot from distracting people so that they don't have that time to think and process and deliberate. And so Cassian was doing something really interesting, which was giving himself time to decide how he wanted to move through this situation rather than having the situation dictated to him.
Yeah.
And I thought Diego Luna, who's the actor for Cassian, I thought his face was so beautiful and compelling in that scene. It's a tight close-up on his face as the guards are approaching and yelling things at him. And you can see the gears in his brain moving over time, right? He's like, I'm about to be put in a situation that I don't want to be in. Mm-hmm. It will get ugly. I might die. I might either be killed or have to kill. How do I want to move through this situation? How do I have agency here?
Especially because the situation is entirely manufactured by the drunk cops.
This is not a situation he wanted to be in.
Nope.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think that makes him more of a understandable character, and it allows him to retain some morality in our eyes, right? Because he didn't want to do any of this. He was forced into it by the society in which he lives, mm-hmm. by the political system in which he is bound and which he's trying to rebel against in a personal way, yeah. not in a structured way, just as a human being. Mm-hmm. He wants to not be controlled by this fascist system.
Yeah.
None of us do.
No, but some of us don't make that our first priority. That's like Brasso's story right there. He's like, system sucks. I work at the brick factory. It's great.
I'm a chill dude.
Yeah, he's a chill dude.
Yeah. That's a cool choice.
Mm-hmm. Who are you choosing?
Yeah, that was not my choice.
Okay. Well, who are you choosing then?
The pickings are slim,
yeah,
Sam.
Yeah, they really are.
I was a little bit tempted to do Brasso because I think he's fun. I love that he brought dinner over and then he caught up pretty fast to what Cassian was trying to do with the alibi. Mm-hmm. He was very good about it. But for now, I'm going to go with B.
Really?
B2. What is B2's name?
B2EMO.
B2 emo?
Yeah.
Me too, B2.
Why?
Because he is janky and good-natured, and it takes so much of his battery pack to lie for Cassian. But he's like, it's okay, I can do it without going home to recharge. And then Cassian's like, okay, but I need two lies. And B2's like, okay, I could do that for you, but I gotta go home and recharge. And like, oh, honey.
I love that for a droid that they have to spend more energy to lie. That's a very funny thing to be true about droids.
Just he's all janky and run down and retro and he gets peed on and he probably smells so bad.
Cassian is like, he grabs like a piece of metal out of him because he's got this funky articulated body. He's like a locker on wheels, but he can extend up and down and wiggle. And he's always stuttering too. It's funny.
People who stutter just have a soft spot in my heart.
Aw.
Yeah, we didn't have a lot of non-reprehensible characters so far. And B2 seems very pure.
I mean, he did shock a dog.
He got peed on. It's like 6 a.m.
Yeah.
That's a lot for anybody, Sam. You try getting peed on at 6 a.m.
It's such a funny scene. B2 is like rolling down the street and just do, do, do. And then like dogs come by and he's like, oh no. And he like ducks down and gets real small and real small. And the dogs run by and he's like looking back at the dogs. He's like, of course they weren't going to eat me. I'm a trash can. And then one dog comes by and pees on him. And he's like, this will not stand. And he just zaps him.
I do indeed have a shock prod specifically for this purpose.
Mm-hmm. I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yeah. So I'm going to go with that.
All right.
I don't feel particularly compelled by my own argument. So let's move on. All right, Sam, what are we watching next week?
We're watching Andor Season 1, Episode 2, That Would Be Me.
That Would Be Me. That Would Be Me. It's a hard delivery. I could never be a voice actor.
We'll find out how they deliver it.
Okay. Where can people find us if they want to get more Skywalker?
I don't want to tell them where we are. But you can find us on the internet at... Growing Up Skywalker on Twitter, on Facebook, on Threads, on Instagram.
You can also find us on Patreon. If you are interested in weekly bonus audio content, you can become one of our patrons. Monthly memberships start at just $3 a month, and we release weekly special profanity-laden content that we don't do on our main show. It is a lot of fun.
And it really helps keep the lights on. And if you notice a change in my tone, it's on a new microphone that we paid for. Thanks to all of our lovely Patreons.
Yeah, thanks, y'all. The last thing you can do to help us out is drop us 5 stars wherever you're listening. If there's an option to leave us a written review, that also really helps just with discoverability and helping us to get in the earbuds of more Star Wars fans.
And send this episode to your sketchy friend.
Yeah, or your drunk uncle.
Or your friend who was most recently peed on by a dog.
Or like someone else who is also struggling against the fascist regime.
Send this episode to everyone.
Yeah. And we'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Bye-bye.